Hier Professor Hartung, hier Professor Galizia, hier visitors or attendees to this exciting lecture of the Zukunftskolleg. I would like to welcome you all to our Zukunftskolleg lecture at the University of Konstanz. On behalf of our university and the Zukunftskolleg, I would like to express my sincere gratitude to you, Professor Ruth Cajón, for traveling from Jerusalem all the way to us here at the Lake of Konstanz and to the University of Konstanz. I'm not sure whether in the maps of Israel, Konstanz is really listed, but in our maps, Jerusalem is listed, and maybe in short time we will have both locations in our heart. We very much look forward to an intensive exchange with you and the University of Jerusalem. Hadassah, Hebrew University, and Hadassah is the medical faculty. The Zukunftskolleg lecture has a long tradition. This event format was introduced in the summer semester of 2011 for the purpose of hosting and honoring dedicated researchers from around the world who cultivate a strong connection with the Zukunftskolleg. During the lectures, exceptional researchers present their work to an interested and interdisciplinary audience from the greater Konstanz area. The university has always placed great emphasis on excellence, which is mirrored in our great success so far in the German Excellence Strategy Competition. At the end of September, two of our initiatives were approved for funding as clusters of excellence, which means we are still in the race of University of Excellence status. Maintaining this status is key for the future of our university and our ability to compete internationally. This goal can only be achieved in cooperation with our international partners and within networks. As an institute of advanced studies, the Zukunftskolleg is at the forefront of our university's internationalization efforts. Just this year, our Zukunftskolleg joined two international networks, the NETIAS, Network of European Institutes of Advanced Studies, which brings together 23 institutes of advanced studies across Europe, and the UBIAS, a network of about 40 university-based institutes for advanced studies worldwide. Ruth Cajón represents one of our renowned international partners, as she is professor at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem and former director of the Martin Buber Society of Fellows in the Humanities and Social Sciences. I would like to extend my heartfelt thanks to her again for visiting us at the University of Konstanz, and would like to express my great welcome to you. Thank you.
So thank you, Professor Pohlstein, for the warm welcome. Thank you, Ruth, for being here. It's great to have you back. The Martin Buber Society and the Zukunftskolleg have a long history. And now I have four pages of Vita to explain to you all the wonderful things that Ruth has done. From Wissenschaftskolleg, Princeton, Rockefeller, Jerusalem. But I skipped that because we come here to listen to you. But please do give me 1 or 2 minutes because I would like to welcome you again and to give you a sort of certificate that you are here for the Zukunftskolleg lecture. And if I can have the certificate and the big thing, everything. The most important thing is you get a mark of the excellent research is my cup of tea. Yesterday, the invitation to the coffee was not just an invitation, we have 2 cups. One that says tea and one that says coffee. You chose the tea yesterday, you get the tea today.
Right.
With some chocolate. And this is the certificate in honor of giving the Zukunftskolleg lecture to the students and scholars of the University of Konstanz, including the Zukunftskolleg, the power and pitfalls of Sonic solidarity, a lesson from the 20th century. And in this hidden book, that is a description of the art of the University of Constance, among which you will also see this piece of art. In case you wonder, one of them is Professor Kriegelstein. But one of them is, because we are not celebrating sort of personality with that. So this is the ancestors of the rector. I don't know whether we haven't filled them all yet. Unlike that one here, we really have names. And for the fellows in the Zukunftskolleg who haven't seen this, this is right at the entrance of the Zukunftskolleg, and it is on the names of the Zukunftskolleg lecture guests, lecturers who have given a Zukunftskolleg lecture. And we discussed yesterday where we will have your name in here, and then it will go back on the wall. I talked too much. Thank you for being here. And we're looking forward to your presentation.
So thank you for closing as much as this view is so beautiful. I want you to see well enough what I prepared for you today. So as I said, I would like also to thank, because I'm really honored and delighted to be here today among friends and colleagues at this really beautiful university and beautiful town, guest of the excellent, vibrant Zukunftskolleg, whose members, as was mentioned, and staff I had the privilege of working rather closely in the last couple of years ago. I thank the board of the Kolleg, and especially Professor Giovanni Galizia for this honor, and Professor Sigrid Elmer for organizing it all so well and so kindly. My lecture today, which is part of an ongoing research project, will take us in particular to German Jewish and Israeli environments, but with a touch of French and American context as well. So this is our plan for today. Just have a look. We'll go through all this. And we'll start, of course, with the introduction. So let us start with fiction, a very real fiction. Fiction that changed reality. We are at a nightclub, Café Américain, owned by the American expatriate Rick Lynn, in the midst of World War II. Yes, you are guessing right. It is Casablanca, the Moroccan city on the Atlantic. It is also the famous movie titled after the city. The club attracts a varied clientele, including Vichy French and German officials, refugees desperate to reach the still neutral United States, and those who prey on them. The date, fictional date, November 1941, a few weeks before the attack in the real time on Pearl Harbor, 7th of December. It is a crucial moment in the plot when the renowned fugitive Czech resistance leader Viktor Lazlo negotiates with Rick about life-saving clandestine letters, and the two are interrupted by the entrance of the Nazi officers singing Die Wacht am Rhein. It takes Lazlo a few seconds to order the house band to play the Marseillaise. See? With Rick nodding his head to the players in agreement, this is how it goes. Just a moment, it's not loud enough.
It's not audible.
Yeah.
Die Wacht, 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 die Wacht
Muslims' presence in a cafe can inspire this unfortunate demonstration, but more than his presence in Casablanca by God. I advise that this place be shut up at once.
So, as you have just heard and seen, a patriotic fervor grips the crowd. At first, some are still hesitating. Then they join in gradually with growing excitement. One woman is even in tears as you saw. When the two melodies are heard simultaneously in an almost coordinated way, and he is waiting to the moment when he will start it so that they will mesh together, we hear a draw. But no, already in the fourth, twice repeated line, the Germans are drowned out and surrendering, sit down. The next line becomes thus very meaningful. Attendez-vous dans les campagnes, mugir ces féroces soldats. Attendez-vous, mugir, so you heard it out. It's something that you should hear. So the song is referring to what's going on. The entire room is now filled with the fanfaring voices and the instruments. When they finish, the victory is complete, prompting a vive la France acclamation by men. The auditory conquest is both real and symbolic. It is real as an experience forging solidarity. While it takes place, people are transformed as they share the spirit of defiance and liberty associated for all with the famous anthem. The words are Le jour de la gloire est arrivé, assume a special meaning. Contre nous de la tyrannie, likewise. It is so real, this victory, that the Nazi commander, Mayor Strasser, ordered the mayor of the city to shut down the nightclub. And yet it's also symbolic. Those who have the spirit, those who defend the right values, will win. The Americans who watched the film since its release in January 1943 in the real world absorbed the message. The legitimation among the American public for the controversial torch operation in North Africa, which according to some scholars, motivated the film producers, was probably reinforced. Apparently, the territorialization of space, time, and spirit through loud and coordinated sounds is a very basic, even atavistic human behavior. The history of humankind seems to be fraught with recorded and unrecorded occurrences in which one group drowns out another with its synchronized voices or sounds. If considered in broader terms, the fashioning of a group's unity and identity through shared singing is a universal phenomenon, which has been recently also neurologically reassessed. Our brains become perfectly matched, or as it is scientifically termed and trained, many of you are familiar with this concept, during such an activity, through a shared external beat. That's we synchronize with the music. Biomusicologists ascribe beat entrainment to an important evolutionary stage in the development of humans. However, with a few exceptions, it is only since modern times that it has become a powerful resource in shaping the political and ideological cohesion of social groups beyond local, religious, or communal governance. The choice of La Marseillaise was not arbitrary in this respect. The French Revolution played a major role in manifesting and embodying the power of revolution, the power of shared singing. From there onward, huge ideological groups, especially during the 20th century, such as the Zionist movements in the turn of the century, or the American Civil Rights Movement in the 1960s, whose image of a typical gathering, singing, you saw it in the poster of this lecture, deployed in such a sync-sonic behavior as an essential part of the sociopolitical practices. So, given all this, I want to present several major questions for this lecture and beyond it. So the first is, why and how did it become so central? The second, how does it metamorphose from local occurrences into a larger socio-political phenomenon? And in addition, what is the social mechanism that triggers solidarity through sound? So it's not just the brain thing, but also the social thing. What sort of mental contents does it foster? When does such solidarity become perilous? And how does it lose its grip? So these are the questions. I will not be able, of course, to do justice to all of these questions in the following 40 minutes, but let's keep them in mind as they all pertain to my attempt to cast some light on the power and pitfalls of sonic solidarity in modern times. So, we are now here. So where it all, and how it all starts. I will start with the first question concerning genealogy. Where and how it all begins. This will take us again to a French-speaking community, however, before the revolution and beyond the French border. Geneva, another picture of this town in those times. The community where Jean-Jacques Rousseau, the great social thinker and Enlightenment ideologue, grew up. In his letter that you see here, to Monsieur d'Alembert on the theater, originally published in 1758, he shares with his readers a precious moment from his childhood when a local regiment, gathering after supper in a place looking like this one, also in Geneva, today, but it's very much alike, starting to dancing all together, officers and soldiers, around the fountain, to the basin of which the drummers, the fifers, and the torchbearers had mounted. The dance of men cheered by a long meal would seem to present nothing very interesting to see. However, the harmony of 500 or 600 men in uniform, holding one another by the hands and forming a long ribbon which wound around, serpent-like, in cadence and without confusion, with countless turns and returns. The excellence of the tunes which animated them, the sound of the drums, the glare of the torches, a certain military pomp in the midst of pleasure, all this created very lively sensation that could not be experienced wholly, obviously. Rousseau tells us. And he continues, the women and the children were already in bed. All of them got up, he continues, together effecting a general emotion that I could not describe, but which in universal gaiety is quite naturally felt in the midst of all that is dear to us. In the middle of this happy turmoil, the narrator's father grips the child and, embracing him, trembling, he utters the following words. Jean-Jacques, love your country. Do you see these good Genevans? They are all friends. They are all brothers. Joy and comfort run in the midst. You are a Genevan, but even if you should travel as much as your father, you will not find their likes. This is a quote from a long footnote at the very end of his treatise, where Rousseau argues against the opening of a theatre in Geneva, an art, he maintains, that induces duplicity, dries up the sources of compassion, spoils virtue, and ruins the solidarity and modest civic life of his Swiss Calvinist hometown was the same one. Communal music and dance, he proposes, are doing the opposite. Instead of weakening the real, the alltäglich, they are elevating it, sanctioning life, and singing, even more than dancing, all share the same experience, without pretense, masks, or an imagined false world that was a new idea at the time that it evolved. Know that this, in principle, a manly military event, that it fostered a feeling of fraternity, and that the qualities Rousseau associates with it are harmony, comfort, warmth, joy, gaiety, and love. It was inevitable that this experience would cast a lasting imprint on the child, an indelible local patriotism, which it did. We will meet many of these sentiments in what follows, especially the values of community, harmony, belonging. In German, as you better know, belonging is as if it were through hearing, through sound, rather than sight or touch, that belonging is generated. Allow me a brief, however related, aside. For the first 20 or 30 years after the birth of the State of Israel, the Independence Day of the young state was celebrated in a way that resembles the Genevan festival. And when I read it the first time, that was what came to my mind. It was especially true, the first one, even before the state, when it was the celebration of the Yishuv following the UN adoption of the partition plan for Palestine, November 20th, 1947. And I remember later the kind of communal festivities in my own childhood. This is an example of such a festivity. But switching back to 18th century Geneva, excuse me for that, I mentioned the Calvinist character of the city. This is of great importance for the history I briefly outlined. Shared sonic worship was central to 16th century reformists' new gospel, under the leadership, of course, of Martin Luther. While in the Catholic Church, music was consigned to a chosen group of singing priests, like what you see in the cathedral of this city, I was there in the morning, the pastor from Wittenberg aspired to forge his flocks into what I term as vocal communities, in which all are singing, all sharing the same musically intoned words. For this purpose, he invented a new genre, the choralism. The choralism thus bypassed the mediation you see here. Bypassed the mediation between the believer and God, so characteristic of the Catholic Church, sung in the vernacular rather than in Latin, in a simple syllabic form and measured bass. It compelled the community to inhale and exhale together, mutually feeling the flow of time and the undulations of the melody and of the emotions. The newly shared vocal ritual ensured the imprint of the theological contents on each and every person in the community gathered in the church. The compilation of the chorals into a printed prayer book, the Lutherisches Gebetbuch, and its dissemination among all evangelist churches rendered a local phenomenon into a trans-denominational one. If you happen to be a traveler in the 16th century or later, no matter in which German Protestant church you alighted, if you were familiar with the Lutheran services, you would always feel musically, liturgically, communally at home. You would feel belonging to the heart. Let us hear now the choralism mostly associated with Luther and the Reformation, Eine feste Ruhe. But we will listen to it, you see it here, and also here in another rendition, but we listen to its performance by a very special group of singers, children, in Michael Henke's film, White Ribbon, or the Das Weiße Band, eine deutsche Kindergeschichte. So with this, we are also going to our third part. here is a typical turn of the 20th century village in North Germany. And the music performed by the Kinder in the balcony seems to embody the community's deeply entrenched ideals, at least apparently, but also its profound inner rapture. These beautiful singing kids are corrupt to the core, that's what we understand from the movie, of this part of when they are reaching this, reflecting the Hippocrates Gemeinschaft, which enveloped itself with these angelic sounds as if to exonerate itself from its own crimes. The scene, the last one in the movie, brings us to the break of the Great War. In the real world, a few years later, the German Jewish philosopher Franz Rosenzweig, who fought in this Great War, would sing the praise of the Lutheran chorale in his celebrated Stern der Erlösung with the following words, which I read in German. So, denn die Musik ist es, die jene erste im gemeinsamen Raum und im gemeinsamen Hören des Worts gegründete Zusammengehörigkeit nun steigert zur bewussten und tätigen Zusammengehörigkeit aller Versammelten. Denn vor dem der Baumus erst geschaffene Raum wird nun von den Klängen der Musik wirklich erfüllt. Denn der Raum füllt von allen gemeinsamen in mächtiger Einstimmigkeit gesungene Choral ist die eigentliche Grundlage der kirchlichen Anwendung der Musik. Und Choral ist die Sprache, die sonst aus jedes einzelnen Mund ihr eigenes und besonderes Wort zu reden wird, zum Schweigen gebracht. Nicht zu jenem Schweigen, das einfach Stunden der verlesenen Worte hört, sondern zu Schweigen einer Eigenheit in der Einigkeit des Ohrs. Zu dieser Gemeinsamkeit des Lebens, wie sie dann im Sakrament sich verwirklicht, stimmt nun die Musik die Seele vor. Joint singing is that which tuned the hearts into Gemeinschaft, life, the communion, renders the togetherness into a felt, embodied reality, shared by all. The silence, it effects, tells us the Jewish philosopher, in the aftermath of the Great War, is a union of hearts, rather than the silence typical ordained listening to the brain. Rosenzweig further sensitizes us to the power of music to elevate the sacred words and to instill moves in accordance with the time of the year, the holiday, thus molding a community of shared calendarial emotions. You may ask, what attracts Rosenzweig, a Jewish thinker, to this mode of Protestant worship? How did he become familiar with it, and why does he include it in his own Opus Magnum, which is very much read and interpreted today? Franz Rosenzweig, born in 1886 in Kassel, was seriously considered at a crucial moment in his life to convert to Protestantism, was familiar with the Jewish rendition of choral singing along with other borrowed Protestant specimens in the renewed synagogue of 19th century Germany. All such reformed synagogues boasted professional choirs, well-trained cantors, in a congregation that was well-versed on the proper ways to participate in the course of the service. These congregations comprised vocal communities similar to those founded by Luther 3 centuries earlier, with an important difference. The kind of organic association of people affiliated for generations with a certain indeed house of prayer, as was the case in pre-modern times, no longer existed. These reformed, you can see, you put it from the inside, this the one that we said beforehand, these reformed synagogues were communities of choice, and there is something communal also in the inside of the building, as Jews during the 19th century could opt for other forms of communal belonging or elude them altogether. As shared traditional Jewish life had lost the grip in them, it was the sonic element above all else that kept them together. and the group was strong enough to maintain their adherence to Judaism and to communal life, to the Gemeinschaft. Other examples from Frankfurt, very famous synagogue. I repeat this German word, Gemeinschaft, not in order to indulge German audience. I do so because the term itself gained importance beyond Germany and the German in that historical moment, coupled with another German term considered its opposite, Gesellschaft. And the sociologists among them, of course, know that. So the German sociologist Ferdinand Tönnies, who introduced these terms, assigned Gemeinschaft to grouping based on feelings of togetherness and on mutual bonds, which he associated with pre-modern organic social collectives, and Gesellschaft, the two groups, much larger in scope, typical of modern times. The Gesellschaft order, he explains, arose in urban and capitalist settings characterized by individualism and impersonal monetary and legal connections between people. Tönnies, like other central German intellectuals of his time, including many German Jews, called for the return of a gemeinschaftliche mode of existence. He and his colleagues regarded the increasing sense of alienation in social relations as a direct outcome of the growing role of science, technology, and industry, of urbanism and bureaucracy in society, and encouraged instead a return to a happy, ideal time, a time of the folk, of the nation. This brings us to the fourth part of this lecture, on the forbidden other singing birds. The new orientation begot a new social constitution of great importance for our topic today, the youth movement. The birds of the first one, the well-known Wandervogel, came about at the onset of the century. This coincidence bespeaks the new hope, the youthful, reinvigorating spirit associated with the rise of the new organization, highlighting simplicity, a return to nature, fraternity, and self-responsibility. It considers group singing as a prime activity and practice alongside hiking and touring the country. The Vögel element actually merged the two. Here's another beautiful picture. Why Vögel? So the wandering and rumbling in the countryside on wild mountains and in steep valleys. And the other side of the bird is, of course, a musical activity. And I'd like to ask you, are you familiar with the combination of the two, hiking and singing together? Anybody's familiar with this? Just, okay. I guess those born in the west side of this country are somehow less than those who were born in the east part. And I will explain this to you soon. In my own youth movement in Israel of the 1960s and 1970s, this was a common and highly effective practice. There were even songs about joint action of hiking and singing. The singing renders the hiking easier, bonding the group and endearing its leaders. But we sang also night around the bonfire, before and after serious ideological discussions, while traveling in old open tracks, and while working in the kibbutz fields. There were work songs, songs of mourning, and songs for the Sabbath and the holidays. There were game songs, dancing songs, and also, I must add, military songs preparing us for the army, and even encouraging death and sacrifice. We always sang. But hey, wasn't I supposed to speak of the Wandervogel? I was. The fact that I so easily sidetracked into speaking about Zionist youth movements is typical. Basically, the Zionist ones were modeled after the Wandervogel. So the Blauweiss was the first among them, and my paternal grandmother, born and raised in Breslau, participated in it already in the 1900s. as she told me later in her life. The affinity between the German and the Jewish youth movements has an ironic touch, or rather a dialectical element. Van der Vogel intellectual leaders such as Hans Gruber were also notorious anti-Semites, and the Zionist youth movement was also born as a response to such erupting anti-Semitism. Anyway, Van der Vogel leaders understood all too well the power of sonic solidarity. And for that matter, they composed Liederbücher, this one, similar to those that Luther had compiled for his congregants. The aim was also, and here I am, in those times, the fact that it's in the National Library of Jerusalem is not, of course, a coincidence. Their aim was also similar, for forging individual communes organized according to age and location. They sought to prepare hearts and minds in the right gemeinschaftliche direction that would be further enhanced by belonging to the larger encompassing youth movement collective. So all those who are belonging to the Band of Oblauers. Secularizing the Lutherish bit, they created a collection which was printed throughout the first decades of the century in numerous editions and variations that comprised a rich variety of genres, styles, and of musicianship, fitting for manifold occasions, ages, and purposes. So you can see another example here. Looks good. Zionist youth movements followed along similar directions. The major difference was, however, that the latter had to start building a canon from scratch. The first Hebrew songs created under this new banner were composed only during the last two decades of the 19th century, while in the German parallel, you find songs dating from the 15th century, 16th century, 17th and so on, and they are only in this little one, you find one. But since the beginning of the 20th century, there was a constant flow of new songs in the Jewish side, in the Hebrew side, that were soon collected in Yiddish, Shironim in Hebrew, for different ages, occasions, creating similar such compendia that were disseminated in the Jewish settlements of Palestine and over the wider swath of Zionist diaspora in Europe and the USA. Here is one of the most renowned ones, which I found in my parents' library as a kid, and seized it in order to learn as many songs as I could, because I was interested in music. I really loved them. Little did I realize at the time that knowing them meant owning a cultural capital of great value. The year it was published, 1935, you can see it here, 1935, is not coincidental. That was the year that the Nuremberg laws and Jews, having been excluded by their German compatriots, felt an urgent need to recreate their own Gemeinschaft, reinvigorating their identity, culture, and solidarity. Here are pictures from one such commune of the youth. Just before that, we'll do something else. This song, I want you to listen a little bit to it. There's something which reminds you of the choir in it, although the melody, go to this, the melody is Ukrainian, so it's much more romantic, harmonic than those, and also minor mode than most of the songs of the ballad. Thank you. I used to sing it in my childhood. And it was, we stood like that, and we sang it in a very kind of serious, solemn way, because we were somehow highlighting and praising this hero that fell, that was killed there in Galilee in 1920, very early in the history of Zionism. So, to go back, and I want to, from here, that's one example of one of these 1940, after 1935 communes, and this was in Hamburg, and I'm sad to say that these girls, most of them did not survive. Very interesting songsters, a singer, Liederbuch is here. And from here we are moving to almost the last part, the pitfalls of sonic solidarity in the case of Hitlerjugend, and or what we've done until now leading us to this. And that's the heavier part of my talk, exemplifying the greatest pitfall of sonic solidarity when it reared its ugliest face in the culture of the Hitlerjugend. We are starting to close the circle we opened with the Wacht am Rhein, which is a song that was composed already in the 19th century in relation to the annexation of the French part of the Alsace-Lorraine. And it's very much related to this military spirit of the Germans in the 19th century. Back to the Hitlerjugend, the organization actually called Hitlerjugendbund Deutscher Arbeiterjugend had its forerunners since the early 20s. It became officially the only youth movement in Germany after the Nazis came to power in 1933, under the leadership of this man, whose name is Baldur Tschirach, banning all others' movements. The modus operandi of such an organization had been already highly lubricated after the 30 years of trial and error of the first youth movements. They adopted most of their practices, enhanced the military aspect and put great emphasis on the musical one, which proved indeed crucial for tuning in the German youth into the war machine and the exterminating units of the Third Reich. How powerful it all was, you can hear from the confession of one such boy named Alfons Heck, born in 1928 in a small town in the Rhineland. And we will hear, we'll see these two clips that interrelated. The documentary is from 1991 in the United States, where he immigrated after the war. It's not an easy film. I bring you, as I said, two short clips that are from taken from two parts of the documentary.
He said, before us lies Germany.
Here?
In us, Germany marches. And after us comes Germany. It was mesmerizing. Hear the Führer speak. That's the feeling that I had at the end of Hitler's speech. Suddenly, you had become invincible. After my return from Nuremberg, life in the town seemed quite boring.
That's important to remember. And now for the second one.
I fully believe that we, as the masterminds, were entitled to eventually rule the world. Nazi functions worked on the principle of music and song.
Music and song.
You always have the music in your ears.
Always music in our ears.
The Nazis really in that sense were unsurpassed masters.
Unsurpassed masters of music.
I don't know if the Germans are more sentimental than other people with singing, but as soon as they begin to sing, the words in a song seem to acquire a meaning.
Meanings in the song.
People use as the flat version. These weren't merely words. All of a sudden, they became a conviction. I think you can compare it to a religious revival meeting. It was soul stirring. Unser Vater flattert uns vor an. Unser Vater ist die neue Zeit. Unser Vater ist mehr als die Ewigkeit. Unser Vater ist mehr als der Tod.
So, then after talks, and that's really what is the next thing that is coming. So, the power of the songs when words were set to music tells us, Mr. Heck, the lyrics suddenly acquired meaning. These are almost the same words we heard from Rosenzweig. Actually, sonic solidarity, as I said in the beginning, is a neutral category vis-a-vis the contents it activates. The phenomenon is universal, but the extent to which the Nazis deployed it for the indoctrination of their ideology and the commitment to their ideals and to the Führer seems unprecedented. How powerful it was, I can tell from a personal testimony, that of my mother, born in Munich in the year of Hitler's putsch, 1923. Between 1934 to 1937, she was the only Jewish girl in the city female gymnasium, a school that became thoroughly Nazified during the years of her studies there. The best student in her class, she underwent daily humiliation on the part of both teachers and peers, about which he kept silent at the time and much later. And there were the songs of the girls and the boys that walked or rather marched around, the Hitlerjugend songs. And she could not help but like some of them and feel terrorized by others. And they looked so good, these boys. She was both attracted and repelled, torn inside and confused, experiencing self-disgust on account of her Jewishness and admiring her classmates. At the same time, she was a Zionist, but was never active in the Zionist youth movement. Arriving in Palestine in June 1937, hearing Hebrew youth, as they were called at the time, singing Eretz Israel Zionist songs, she could not help but utter what she told me with great wonder. So we too have such songs. An example, a little bit different. And yes, we did have our songs, but mostly not so similar to the German ones. And that was a great comfort for her and other such refugees and a way to easily integrate into the new life of the developing home country, while absorbing the moods, the spirits, the life circles, the feeling of togetherness through these songs. The fate of such songs in Palestine, Israel, and Germany was, however, different. In post-war Germany, under the American and British rule, they were banned. That's what I referred to when I asked you the question beforehand. And even group singing became prohibited, as Juliane Brauer explains in her research. In the GDR, it was different. It's very interesting. I cannot enter into this now. In young Israel, the anti-Semitic songs continued to flourish, always adding new songs to the quite enormous chorus until at the end of the 1960s, they partially lost the standing, the canonic standing. And this happened when other musical repertories, rock, oriental, and so forth, gained increased attention and popularity. One of the most influential foreign elements that affected this change in Israel in the Israeli song culture was the new youth culture associated with the civil rights movement, the hippies, and other cosmopolitan tendencies. And this brings us to the finale, turning Gesellschaft into an encompassing Gemeinschaft. This brings me to the concluding part of my talk, in which I will briefly touch on the American scene. In this final part, I want to look at the history and case studies I have discussed from a higher sociological and political perspective. What I wish to argue is that the instances of sonic solidarity, which bear political importance, reveal a certain shared structure and dynamics. This can already be discerned in the consideration, in the confederation of Protestant churches created by Luther, in which the emotions and sentiments, primarily those of bonding and solidarity among its members, developed from within the realm of individual churches, were meant to be vicariously projected onto the confederated one. My contention is that such aggrandized sense of belonging to the Gemeinschaft is different from the mode of identification Benedict Anderson famously called imagined community. It is different because it is more real, embodied, experienced, lively, connected. You could hear in the microcosm, in the macrocosm, the microcosm, and vice versa. You could feel the joint breath, the melodic togetherness, and the seasonal changes you are familiar with from your local church. You would not have to imagine much for this purpose. You become a member of a bigger encompassing whole through the encompassing whole through vocal liturgical practice. Indeed, such a whole, even in modernity, will no longer feel nor act as the alienated Gesellschaft that Turnus and his colleagues spoke about. The moment we are feeling this huge togetherness, we do not feel anymore this kind of less familiar and less warm sort of togetherness. Intentions and vision, however, did not suffice to accomplish such a task. Luther and those who followed suit in creating the confederation of vocal communities took care to operate in effective transmitting media that would multiply such communities within the larger collective they aimed at. Now, as far as Luther was concerned, it was a newly invented print industry that by and large made his revolution possible, but particularly promoted his vocal reformation. Of course, it's true for also for the dissemination of the Bible, but very much for chorale. It was still through print that the Wandervögel leaders disseminated their sonic gospel, but the actual transport of people from place to place expedited the diffusion of the songs. The trends were the culprits. The ships from Palestine, in the Zionist case, brought also vocal emissaries throughout the songs everywhere. About the time, there emerged another vital, novel technology that rendered communication even faster and more immediate in both cases, the mechanical sonic reproduction, phonograph, which was followed by another crucial invention, of course, the radio. One, of course, cannot overstate the importance of broadcasting for the Nazi propaganda in general. Also, the proper songs were disseminated through this favorite box, the centerpiece of every household in Germany at the time. And again, transportation proved of special importance, as we saw. It is through trains, I suppose, that Alfons Hex, that we saw, and its comrades from all over Germany arrived to the megalomaniac constitutional moment in Nuremberg, which we watched together. There, the kind of experience young Jean-Jacques Rousseau had witnessed at his hometown was exponentially multiplied. But was it indeed the same kind of experience, aggrandized? Was it the same, just aggrandized? or was it something totally different? It seems that such spectacular events encompassing throngs amount to the birthplace of a mob culture. This is the relevant slide for this. And the French psychologist Gustave Le Bon, seen here, author of the Psychologie Ford, here, famously maintained already in 1895, the assimilation into such an organism transforms each person into something radically different from where and what he or she had been before. It lets the eruption of repressed drives, argues Le Bon, allowing for the suppression of the conscience and sense of responsibility. Sigmund Freud, in his Massenpsychologie und Ich-Analyse, published after the Great War, pointed out that by taking in such a mass, the individual feels endowed with enormous power, cancelling the sense of the impossible. This sense of assimilation onto the larger group and of self-aggrandizing is easily applied to the Hitler-Jugend case and in general is optimally attained among adolescents. Can we apply it also to the other cases we have discussed and to the one which we mentioned in passing, the American Civil Rights Rights Parade? Here's an example of such a moment. Can such dangerous power, as we saw, be restrained? Maybe attempt to forge such huge Gemeinschaft collective, even in what seems as the better cases, should be avoided, as we never know where they can lead to. This is a grave question, and of course, cannot be thoroughly answered in the last 2 minutes of my talk. I would therefore only briefly state my own belief here. Such solid collectives have, in rare times, a justifiable place within other social and political human endeavors. They should be always restricted in both time and purpose, as the big human rights parades actually were. And we must listen to one moment of this. Shalom in the big rally in the square a few minutes before Yitzhak Rabin was assassinated. Shir Shalom, very famous one. Moreover, shared emotions and enthusiasm fostered by synchronized music within real or more imagined collective events should be carefully monitored by sensitive leaders who should remind the audience why they have assembled, what the purpose of their struggle is, as well as adjust sonic solidarity to an ethically and politically balanced overview. From that point of view, the larger frame of society should never act in a gemeinschaftlich way. That is my belief. Or aspire to be one, as German sociologist Jürgen Habermas and following suit the Israeli Uri Ram have alerted us. And yet the question still remains, who will educate future citizens to ever process, assess, and judge what is it that they are doing together, to whom, and why such and such moods are evoked, and whom a gathered collective is excluding, including, or hailing, This is a question I would address you, the audience, future academic leaders and other committed citizens. Unfortunately, in prominent free countries, including, I am said to say, Israel, this general political framework that would enable such civic education is no longer self-evident. So before the discussion, I would still wish to stress, despite all this, that we should never despair of taking care of imparting an aesthetic education that was part of the vision of Schiller in this country, in which music should find an important place, honored in a socio-liberal democratic, anchored in a socio-liberal democratic framework. Such aesthetic education will not shy away from fomenting a rich gamut of emotions bound up with developed rational skills. We don't have to be afraid of emotions, but rationality should be there. Encouraging creativity, reflection, and understanding of the human condition and its potential. So, thank you very much.